there a writing craft book on your bedside table? Has it been there for a while?
Do you keep meaning to get past chapter 2, or chapter 1, or just the first page?
Then the Words to Write By podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Renee. I teach composition and creative writing to college students. My background is in poetry, but I'm working on my memoir.
And I'm Kim. I'm trained as a science journalist, but now I'm trying my hand at short fiction. Each week, we'll be tackling a chapter of some well-known, but perhaps not so well-read, writing craft book.
Together, we'll uncover brilliant insights, face the hard truths, and totally disagree when the author is wrong.
This is our podcast, after all.
And then, we're going to take what we learn and apply it to our own writing.
By doing the book's suggested exercises.
We're inviting you to read along, or just tune in for the Cliff Notes version.
We're committed to improving our own craft, one writing advice book at a time, and we'd love for you to join us.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we've started a new book, Ray Bradbury's Zen in the Art of Writing. If you'd like to participate in some of these activities or read the show notes, go over to Patreon. We'll give you more information at the end of the podcast, so tune in. Welcome.
Welcome to Words to Write By.
Welcome to Words to Write By. Kim, what words have you written?
I have had a really good set of writing. I had a couple critique groups, and I got things prepared for each. For my local one, I got the first rewrite version of my cyber-stalking mom story. And for the Berkeley Writers Circle, I read the first part of the short story that I came up with using Ray Bradbury's noun subconscious technique that we discussed in episode 9.
Cool. So the body one where it, the copies of people.
Yeah.
The ring. Is it going to be called The Ring?
No, it's going to be called Triptych.
Oh, that's a cool name. I look forward to reading that story.
Mm-hmm. How about you? What words have you been writing?
Well, I did write an article. Actually, I revised an article that will be going up on our website very soon. It's about reverse outlining your calendar so you can decide where all your time went. If you're wondering why you don't have any time to write, you discover that you had it. You just spent it on other things. You made different choices. Sometimes, though, you wonder where the time goes and you were doing work. You just didn't feel like it. A lot of the time, I'm really hard on myself. And then I do the reverse calendar and I go, wait a minute. I did a lot of stuff. It's very easy for me to start just blaming myself. I've actually been very busy. I just haven't been creating that much writing, which is something I need to relook at and be like, all right, what am I spending my time on? And I need to hunker down, butt in chair, and write a bit more. So tune in for next episode when Renee talks about, hopefully, how she got her butt in the chair and sat there and wrote.
Always hopeful.
Always hopeful.
In today's episode, we learn Bradbury's technique for writing 25,000 words of Fahrenheit 451 in 9 days. And we try to figure out if this could work for our own writing lives. We also compare Bradbury's mining of his childhood for the writing of his fiction book, Dandelion Wine, to Renee's own memoir research.
So, the next two chapters we're covering is chapter 5 and 6, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The first one's called Investing Dimes, Fahrenheit 451. This one, I think, was an introduction to his book, but it was talking about the book in past tense terms. So I think it was like 20 years after he had written it.
Right. So when they were reprinting a lot of these books that were now very famous, Fahrenheit 451, because it's often used in school curriculums, probably gets bought a lot. People were more interested in how he went about writing the book. And so for Zen and the Art of Writing, he incorporated some of these introductions into it.
Does that not strike you as a little odd? I mean, it struck me as a little odd. I kind of had to ask myself the question, why are these introductions in a book on how to write or writing advice?
You have to remember that this isn't a standard writing advice book. It's not wedded to the idea that every chapter progresses and teaches a different aspect of writing. The cynical part of me says he was putting enough pieces in here to fill out a full book.
So he was like recycling his work to fill it out?
You know, people recycle their work. In journalism, it's quite common if you get a particular beat and you're writing various stories on it. You know, you pitch to one magazine and they accept it and you write that piece and then something else comes up and you write that as a news story for another publication. At a certain point, you become an expert in this area and you want to turn this all into a book. Sometimes you re-interview, but there's a lot of what went before incorporated into it. Mm. And it's an acceptable practice. So, yeah, I mean, he reused some stuff. But the question is, why do you think he included it? How did he think this would benefit the book? How did he think this would benefit the reader?
Well, the first read through, I asked myself that question. He talked a bit about how he had to rewrite it for a stage production and how he redrudged up all those old characters and they did different things than they did in the original novel. And so the whole time I'm like, is he talking about going back and reusing stuff and changing genres of work you've already done? But then when I read it again, he has a whole part in the beginning about his process. And I think perhaps it's more about that. He talks about how he was really distracted at home. He always wanted to just play with the kids and not work. And so he had to find an office, but they didn't have a lot of money. So he went to the library and they had these typewriters where you could put a dime into it and it would turn on for a half hour. So he would throw these dimes in and the timer was going down and he would just sit in that library and he just typed out that whole book in 9 days. And I was like, damn,
now that's impressive. Now that was a shorter version.
Right. He said at 25,000 words, it was half the novel it eventually would become.
So he had an initial version of the story and then it was expanded. But yeah, 25,000 words. I did the calculations.
Of how much it cost him?
That too. he was writing 2,800 words a day.
Wow.
In comparison, for people doing NaNoWriMo, they only need 1,600 words a day.
Dang. He was very, very prolific.
Probably a fast typer, too.
Yeah, I'm a pretty fast typer, but my ideas are very slow.
I think we'd find ourselves less fast if we didn't have a backspace key.
That's true. Oh, yeah, if you're on a typewriter.
Yeah. On the other hand, all a typewriter can do is type. It can't check the news or see what's happening on Facebook.
So that brings up the next question. Can this be remanufactured? I gotta say, man, I feel like in some ways, writers of the past had it good. They could wall themselves up somewhere and not.
They also would spend hours trying to figure out some detail of some story. Ray Bradbury talks about when he's writing this book that he would occasionally leave the typewriter and just wander the halls of all these books. But the other side was that if he wanted to find something out, he had to look in a book.
That's true. But then, you know, you got to go on walks. I mean, I go on my runs. You have to take breaks. But his breaks were not brain candy, at least brain candy in the sense of bad candy like Facebook or other social media where you get that dopamine hit. He was getting a dopamine hit from looking in books.
There was nothing else to do. I mean, I suppose you could wander to like the newspaper section of the library.
Definitely. I don't know. Do you think it's possible? I feel it's like people's expectations of you have changed everything.
I wonder if we would write differently if we were in a situation where there was no distractions for 6 hours. And this is what people do with writer retreats. People go places without Wi-Fi and hold themselves up.
So you think it's possible then? I mean, how realistic is it for you to sit in a chair and just sit there and write for hours?
I think it'd be completely possible for me to do it once. How realistic would it be for me to do it day after day? Not so much. But even he said he did 9 days of this. He probably did 9 days of it and then he collapsed for a week or something.
I think he did it every day, didn't he?
Right. But 9 days if he didn't do it on weekends, be it about 2 weeks.
Yeah. Dang.
He was a prolific writer and a lot of professional writers write a significant portion of every day. That's how you get a book out a year.
That's true. That's true. He wrote fast. How is it possible? I mean, do you write fast when you write?
When the ideas are all coming to me? Pretty much, yeah.
Huh. Do you handwrite first or do you type first?
I handwrite first.
Okay. Interesting.
When the ideas are coming to me, I write fast. When I get hung up on editing or like I can't quite get into something, then the ideas come slower. My hand writes slow. I'm not sure which.
I am so utterly distracted all the time. Maybe it's my personality. I don't know. I'm very good at saying, okay, don't look at my phone for 2 hours. And I won't. But then when I do, it's like I get stuck in it. And then I end up hating my phone. And then I have all these tricks to try to avoid my phone. And then there's my email. And then I don't even like email. I don't even like, no offense, Instagram, but I don't really like social media. You know, I like to think of myself as a Luddite, but I'm not because I still check Reddit. I still check our Instagram. I feel kind of like I have no choice but to be distracted. The world has
It moves too fast. It's too loud and blinky.
I guess. It's like I feel like the tech moguls have designed the world to make it very difficult for me to turn off. It really annoys me.
Yeah, I think pretty much anybody you talk to that has a smartphone that lives in the modern world would tell you there's too many distractions.
When I was in college, I didn't have a Facebook. I didn't have social media. I had one of those pay cell phones, you know, flip phone. I didn't know how to text until I went to grad school. And I didn't even carry a phone with me to my undergraduate. Man, I miss those days sometimes. I felt myself so much more focused. But then you look back on it and you go, that's not necessarily true. Although I was very focused, I had a bunch of deadlines. You have a teacher giving you deadlines. You have very serious consequences if you don't fulfill those deadlines. Those kinds of things really fueled me. And then when you graduate and you're off into the real world and there's no more deadlines besides work, then you don't do anything. What do you think?
I think you're right. I think you nailed it. I think this is the reason why we have NaNoWriMo. I think this is the reason why we have do this for a month or this challenge or whatever, is because people are looking for something to grab hold of to say, I will do this one thing. I can't do it forever. I can't do it every single day, but maybe if I just do it for a month, maybe if I just do it for a week, maybe if I just do it for 6 hours.
6 hours.
So let's move on to this next chapter, which is also a preface to a novel which I never read. And it's called Dandelion Wine. I never knew about because I was used to Bradbury's science fiction and weird stories. This is a semi-autobiographical story set in the town he grew up in that his grandfather and family lived in.
The chapter is called Just This Side of Byzantium, Dandelion Wine. And I'd heard of it. In the chapter, he talks about how he very much enjoyed listening to a radio play of this novel. And so I went and found the radio play and I listened to it. And it was delightful. It was a little hard to get into because there was no narration. It was just actors just getting right into it. It was a little hard to follow in the beginning, but once I figured out what was going on, it was lovely. Ray Bradbury must have had a wonderful life because it was just wonderful. Even with wonderful things happening, he found ways to put tension in there. I was very impressed. And like, I was very curious as to what would happen next. It was like an ode to his childhood. And he somehow just captured the 12-year-old boy brain. All of the characters were directly taken from his life.
I think the reason why he included this preface in this book is he talks here about how he got back to those memories. And mostly this preface is for people that are going to read Dandelion Wine that's probably read in the past or want to see how it's done. So it's got a whole bunch of references to this element and that element. There's a lot of shout-outs to what comes in the book. This is designed to go before a beloved novel. However, what I got out of it was just all the different things he remembered in order to write the story and all the sensory detail that went with it and all the emotional detail that went with it. This comes pretty close to writing memoir, which is what you do, Renee.
This is what I try to do. Okay, so let's just start real quick of what he said about mining his childhood, and then I can maybe kickstart off that. Once I learned to keep going back and back again to those times, I had plenty of memories and sense impressions to play with, not work with, no, play with. Dandelion Wine is nothing if it is not the boy hid in the man playing in the fields of the Lord on the green grass of other Augusts in the midst of starting to grow up, grow old, and sense darkness waiting under the trees to seed the blood. Like, whew, he's a good writer. He's very whimsical. He's very childlike. Unlike Bradbury, I did not have a very idyllic childhood. I think I might have had the opposite. And, you know, I really enjoy reading this positive stuff because I feel like I'm going on a vacation to somebody else's childhood. With this story, Dandelion Wine, that's very much where I went.
I suspect that it was very enjoyable for him to just pull back on those memories when he got them.
Yeah, it was very clear that the love was just bleeding off the pages. I mean, he loved his family. He loved Illinois. He loved just being a kid. I did not like being a kid.
My guess is it's not quite that same rose-colored memory.
No, I think he would think back to the past and be happy. Whereas I can't help but think of the past and it just hits me, you know, and I'm like, damn it. Or just little things. It's hard because I think about it a lot. I've gotten a lot better now that I go to therapy, but like I used to have a hard time even having conversations with people about what they would consider normal things. And for me, it was not normal. And I caught myself in a lot of conversations saying, don't say it out loud, Renee. Just don't say it out loud. There's no reason. Just don't do it. But you're obviously there in that other space.
So it sucks for real life, but when you're writing a memoir, being able to reach back to those places is critical.
Right. Bradbury said, I had plenty of memories and sense impressions to play with, not work with, no, play with. And I think that's a very important distinction. He's not writing his childhood verbatim as it happened. He's playing with it. We don't know how much of it is fiction and how much is autobiographical. It's important to know that when you're writing it down, your life down, it has to be digestible. It has to be edible. And that means changing the form. It might mean how you remember it depends on what you're doing. There's details I had forgotten that I put in later.
So how do you find those details? Like, even though you guys are reaching back to different sorts of memories, you're still both reaching back. How do you do it? Do you have a process?
I do. Usually what I do is I have a list of scenes. So I wrote, a while ago, I wrote a list of things that I felt were important that would probably going to end up in a memoir. Like a sentence or two. You know, the time I threw up in the McDonald's when I got to Sacramento. Then I kind of take a step back and I look at it like, okay, well, which chapter am I going to write? Then I just write each scene. I try not to think about it because the more thinking I do, the less work I get done. And I really have to mind my brain. I really got to ask, like, what was really going on? What do I remember? What's the spin I'm going to take on it? For example, my grandmother was an alcoholic. She wasn't abusive to me and my brothers, but she was to my mom growing up. And we kind of had to live with her for a short time. And one day my mother, in the middle of the night, woke us all up. Me and my brothers were taken to the car and we just left grandma's house. We didn't wake her up or anything. We just disappeared. And I did not find out till like 35 years later what happened.
But when you're writing the scene, you're trying to get back to you at that age being woken up in the middle of the night and being taken to the car, right?
Right. So I have to think, what is my kid brain thinking? But then what is my adult brain thinking now? How do I fill in the blanks and negotiating what I knew then with what I knew now? I didn't know what my mom was doing. I didn't know my grandmother was an abusive alcoholic. I didn't know those things at 6 years old. My biggest issue is trying to figure out the motives of others. Why would my mother do that? I know why I did certain things, but why did my mom do that? Why did my grandmother do that? That's where I get hung up because a lot of the people in my family are what we call genetically loaded and they don't do things that make sense. So figuring out their motives is kind of hard.
And one approach you've done is you've got a therapist, right?
Oh, yes. So I have a therapist and she's a trained professional and she helps me figure it out. I can't for certain say in the book what my family was thinking, but I myself need to figure it out. Therapy has been really helpful because they make you go down the rabbit hole. They know what questions to ask. Like, well, how do you feel about that? And why do you feel that way? Could it be this or could it be that? Then they'll sometimes give you revelations that you hadn't considered before. And you're like, oh, I've been thinking about that scene half my life. And now I've finally figured out what is the damn point of it all.
Now, the other thing that you run into is you lived in a whole bunch of different places and you can't get at them. Bradbury could go back to the small town. He could walk the exact same places he walked as a kid, as an adult, and just trigger those memories.
I can do that.
Do you do that?
I couldn't go to just one small town. I moved about 20 times by the time I was 18. I went to a dozen public schools. I had moved so many places, my memory is kind of, I'm not going to say weird. It maybe doesn't work the same as other
patchy.
People's. It is very patchy. I was trying to write a scene that happened. It was very clear in my head, you know, where I was. But I couldn't really remember the neighborhood. It was on P Street in Sacramento, in downtown Sacramento. And so I went on Google Maps, and I didn't know the address. I don't know the addresses to any of these places. And I was like 7 or 8. I don't even know where things are. But because of Google Maps and being able to search around, I found the place. And I found the alleyway that I was writing about.
And did that help the writing?
Oh, yeah. I was writing a scene. I apparently, I didn't know this at the time. Again, with the internet, it makes writing memoir very surreal because you can look up events that had taken place if they were somewhat historical, right? You can find the newspaper articles and stuff. When if you wrote a memoir in the past, you'd have to like go to the library and pull up Laserfiche and be a big pain in the butt. So I'm on P Street. I was in the alleyway and that's where we played. And the kids didn't really know each other. We would just show up, we would play, and then we would leave. Like I didn't have any lasting friends there. And this old lady got arrested because she had been taking in men, boarding them or whatever, and then killing them and burying them in the backyard, like taking their social security checks. It was only a couple blocks away from where I was living. And I don't know how the kids got a hold of this information. You just do. And it just started buzzing around the alley. It was like, that's how it was talked about. Kids sharing information with other kids about this scary old lady who lived in a house. And it was very helpful to go onto Google Maps. I did a little search. I walked through Google Maps to the lady's house. Apparently, she's a big character on those true crime podcasts. I was kind of close to something historical, sort of.
So did you check the newspaper then to...
Yes, I went down the, I forget her name, but I went down the rabbit hole of seeing how it happened, when it happened. And that was really weird. Here's how one could play with this whole process and by what I think Bradbury means with play. Although, as a kid, I did not know who this lady was, how far away she lived, although I knew she lived close. That's all I knew. But now I read all that stuff. And in an essay or a chapter in a memoir, I could pull that information that my 8-year-old self did not have access to. I could, if I wanted to, write about my experience going on to Google Maps and slowly lead the reader to the house and then slowly reveal who I'm talking about. And then I could cut to my kid persona and talk about being a kid, then cut back to an article about this woman, and then cut back to me being a kid, and slowly the kids start telling stories. Maybe that's the point. The kids tell a story in a certain way. That's playing. That's not, this is exactly how it happened, because no one's going to read that shit. Nobody just reads it because it happened. It has to have some kind of meaning. So you would play with your memory, which for me, I don't mind. I'm sure some people are like, I must write how it happened. I'm like, these horrible memories have to be good for something. If I have anything, I definitely have those. And they're mine, and I'm going to do with them what I want. I mean, I'm still following the rules of memoir. I'm not lying. But I do play.
Both the Dandelion Wine and also what you're talking here reminded me of a book I read a while back by William Maxwell. And it was called So Long, See You Tomorrow. It travels the same kind of space. When he was a child in the 1920s, there was a murder in the town between these two couples that various bits of drama. And he was a small child. He didn't pick up on any of these things, but he was aware that this happened. He was aware there was a boy roughly of the same age of him. And there was a couple days that two of them actually played together before this kid was taken away. His mother left town. The piece is both his memories of his childhood, the various things that happened after his mother died and his father remarried, but also his speculation about this other child and what his life must have been. It got into his head. That book then switches to when he actually goes back and researches the local newspapers to find out what these events were that had happened. And it's a beautiful novel. It's both a tribute to his growing up and an examination of why he was the person he was, how he discovered his love of writing, and then this weird event that would just balanced it and just made it much more compelling than if it was just simply his childhood.
And it was written when?
It was written in 1980.
I might read that. I really like that. I think it's important to note that Bradbury is definitely mining his childhood for ideas, and people use characters from their lives in their fiction all the time. But I'm not saying that this is what happened, because we can't talk to Bradbury anymore. But at the time that Bradbury was writing Dandelion Wine, memoir was not exactly accessible yet. It wasn't a genre yet, believe it or not.
It was more autobiography.
Well, autobiography is you writing your whole life from beginning to end. He was writing about a specific time and place. It was a coming-of-age story. And he wrote it in fiction. Now, he did have a little bit of a sci-fi element. I'm not going to spoil the story, but if memoir were available to him, maybe he would have written a memoir.
So in the end, do you think these two chapters belonged in this writing book?
It's weird because I feel if this is supposed to be a craft writing book, I think he would have added more examples, perhaps. He talks about his books as if you've already read them. Whereas a craft book has kind of a teaching element, and they don't necessarily expect you to have read another book in order to write like them. But then again, when we read Gardner, he was name-dropping all over the place. And he just assumed you should be reading Homer and Ovid. Do you think these chapters are helpful to a writer?
I think these kind of chapters could easily be quickly read, and you could lose the thread. I find that a book that is constantly bringing you back to the points, you become a very focused and intense reader. When I want to get information out of something, I have to be focused. I have to be reading all the sentences. I have to be picking up on stuff and underlining. And these chapters are enjoyable, but I could read them very quickly and get very little out of them. And then I might have a hard time engaging later on in the book with other details. Because we're doing this for a podcast, I focus anyway. The first four chapters of this book gave us some really solid writing advice or things to build off of. These ones, not so much.
Yeah, these ones, not so much. If you really like Bradbury, these are like a treasure trove of nuggets of information.
If you really like Bradbury, you probably have both the books with these prefaces in them already.
Right, you've probably already read a bunch of Bradbury. There are some little nuggets in them. Like, he goes on and on and on about the characters of Fahrenheit Horror 51. He even puts a scene in there that he changed, like, I'm going to remember the original. You know, that wasn't so helpful, but he did talk about how he wrote it.
There's also just the sort of showing that you've got the chops. Mm-hmm. And writing about his own writing this way shows that he has the chops of writer. This is not Gardner's, let's throw off a random plot and claim that it could actually be a novel.
Yeah.
When you're reading this book, you can say, yes, Bradbury is somebody worthy of studying because, man, he could do this stuff. Yeah. Like you said, Dandelion Wine was an amazing book that had very little outward tension, but was still a compelling read.
Yeah, well, there was still tension in it. He somehow found a way to include both the ode and then the tension at the same time. So far, just so far. I mean, we haven't finished the book yet. But if the rest of the book goes this way, where there's just prefaces to his books, would you recommend all of these chapters to somebody if they wanted to read the book? Or would you say, you know what, just read those parts with the advice and the other ones, eh?
The first four chapters, if you just read those, would be a fantastic craft exploration.
Yeah, but you'd miss out on the dime novel. I didn't know they had typewriters that had dimes. I want them back. I want my own typewriter. I have to put a dime in it and the timer goes down.
So I'm thinking our exercise for this week. Actually, we've talked about this before. It's not spontaneous because I'm sure if I just presented to Renee, she wouldn't do it.
Oh, well, yeah, well, she's probably right.
But we're going to try to recreate 6 hours of a Ray Bradbury day. We haven't quite figured out how we're going to do it, but we're going to go out and do this. And we're going to come back and tell you how we did it.
Yeah.
And how it went.
It's kind of scary. I'm hoping I can pull that off. We shall see.
It's a challenge. And we're back after our writing stints.
Phew!
Let's start off by saying what we did or what our plan was. What was your plan, Renee?
Okay, so I decided to go to a cafe because that's what I did in the before times. The before times might be returning. I should risk it. So I went to a cafe called Big Mug and found myself a spot and then changed the spot and then changed the spot until I found a spot in the back. Once, you know, enough people left and I was like, oh, and I wormed my way into the back, into a nice little cozy corner.
And my plan was to go to an actual library. So I'm in Santa Cruz and we have a university up on the hill and I have an alumni membership. So I could go up there and check myself into the building for the day. And I found a quiet study spot where there were a bunch of people working, but nobody was allowed to talk.
Nice. Oh, I miss that campus. Which library were you in?
I was in McHenry.
Oh, it's a nice one. They've updated it now, huh?
I think it's updated. You know, it's one of those old concrete bunker libraries with bookcases so tight that you actually have to roll them out to get into various places. Just got a certain quiet quality when you're surrounded by concrete. and people actively not talking. It was a good vibe. It really worked.
You know, McHenry Library is where I found most of the banana slugs. I wrote many an essay in that basement. So,
well, I was up on the fourth floor, so I had windows.
There were computers in the basement back in the day. I don't know if they even use it anymore. I used to hide out there, write lots of essays. So you did go to the library.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the cafe. Excellent. So for you, did it work out? What happened?
I got 2,300 words written total, and I got about 1,500 that were really good words. Like, you know, it goes through stages. And for our Patreon listeners, we're going to put a bonus podcast where we made recordings along the way. And so you can kind of hear how it went in real time, as opposed to this nice sum up. When I was productive, I did some really good writing. And when I lost productivity, it was close enough to the end that I was just going to type out what I'd written previously in my notebook and not worry about any kind of typos or things, just get it out on the page. So that's how I made the 2,300 words.
You had the goal of a word count. You said, I want to write 2,300 words.
No, I didn't have a goal, but I had, we never actually talked about what we were working on. So I was working on the short story I've discussed in the previous bonus podcast with the brain transfer thing. And my goal was to do the entire rough draft. And I got about 2/3 of the rough draft done.
Wow. From the beginning, 2/3 in?
Well, I probably had about 1/3 of it written before then.
So you wrote 1/3 of it, or another 2/3 of it?
I wrote another 1/3 of it.
Nice.
And what was your goal?
My goal was to just write for 6 hours. I didn't even have like a word count goal, but I knew I was writing my memoir. It was like, all right, I need this to be useful. I really needed to get back into it. I had to take a short hiatus after somebody dies, who's a main character in your memoir. I used this as the opportunity to be like, okay, it's been a few months. I could get back into this. I need to get back into just writing this book in general. And so I used this as the opportunity to jump back in the pool. And it worked out. I ended up writing the first day, 1,836 words.
Were there any stuff that you've been working on before that you were fixing up, or was it all just fresh from your brain?
I did a little like pre-party planning the night before and did some free writing just to prime my brain. Some of that free write ended up being transcribed the next day. I had that as my back, like, okay, if I'm just sitting there staring at the wall and I can't get anything out, I have this stuff to transcribe.
Prime the pump.
Yeah, prime the pump. It's usually part of my process anyway. I tend to free write and then I transcribe everything I free write. Then I print it and then I have it next to me as I edit. But I didn't have a printer because I'm a big bug. So I transcribed it and then kept going. But there was a bit of a snag. I kind of failed. I didn't do the whole 6 hours. I know that's awful.
6 hours is a really long time. I found that my last hour and a half, 2 hours was not nearly as productive.
So you did it in one go. You didn't take any breaks?
Well, I stopped for lunch, but I actually brought my notebook down when I was at lunch and I was writing in my notebook.
Wow.
And I got up a few times and walked the book stacks. So that was nice.
That's what Bradbury did.
Exactly.
Oh, I love it. That's great. I wish we had a nice library out here. I actually tried to go to the library. I went to the Big Mug for a couple hours. I went and ate lunch and then I went to the library and it was closed for Good Friday. And I have a little rant on that. Y'all listen to that later. I miss that UCSC, those two libraries they have. The one out here, San Jose State's library, is just a public library. And as pretty as it is, it's not a very good place to study. So what I did, I kind of sort of made up for it. I guess I lost some points, if there's points to be had. I did 4 hours. Then the next day, I felt bad and I woke up and I sat down for 2 hours and finished. So I had kind of a split shift between 2 days.
Good.
Would you do this again in your future?
I have such a great resource of having the campus so close and access to it. And it's just really amazing to leave everything in the house. And also the Wi-Fi doesn't work very well up there. It's sporadic. So that helps. It was really cut off. So I think I will do it again. I'm not sure if 6 hours is doable. I think that I would have actually gotten a lot more if I just gone up there, worked, and then when it was lunchtime, gone home and just called it good.
So you think maybe those last 2 hours weren't as productive?
When you're doing a new project, there's the enthusiasm of something new and that kind of willpower. Like you woke up the next day and you went back to do some writing because were that enthusiastic and that obligated because of the podcast. And then there's that habit building, which obviously Bradbury was at when he was describing his working. That was his thing. He got up in the morning, he went to the library, he typed out for that period of time, he went home. He did enough that his brain just followed the schedule. I don't think I'm up for creating a writing schedule like that. I think my life's a bit too chaotic. Even without distractions, there's the podcast and other stuff that we're working on that just takes a lot of time. So I'm not able to commit that kind of regular writing. But, you know, once a week, that's completely doable. And that's something I might look into. How about you?
This draft has taken me so many years. If I sat there for 6 hours a day for 3 days a week, this would get done. Maybe it wouldn't be a great draft, but I would have something complete, which is not something that I have. I woke up with a little kick in the pants, like, wow, I think I really could do this.
You're actually a lot closer to getting done than you thought you were. And now the question is, do you want to commit that time to finishing it up?
I might. Bradbury has really inspired me in different ways. From the last podcast, we did the Muse menu activity where we read a poem, a short story, and creative nonfiction. I'm still doing that. I love that. And then this 6 hours is a bit much, but it drew attention to the distractions that I have and what I'm actually able to do and the limits that I need to put on the people and the events in my life that are preventing me from actually doing something like that, which I think I should be able to do given where I am in my life and the obligations I do have. For example, I committed to do it on Friday, but it was my husband's off Friday. And then he wants to engage in our Friday banter of whatever. And I'm like, I have something I committed myself to do. And it just, he almost made it impossible for me to do that. And I did finally get into the chair, but by then I was just like emotionally worked up from some conversations that I was like, I'm going to still do this, but man, I can see this being very difficult to sit there and do it. And I thought, well, if I want to get up and write for 6 hours, maybe Monday when he's at work, what other things are in my way that I need to get out of my way? And so I'm just predicting all of these things, like changing mentally exhausting tasks, you know, switching from one to the other. I'm like, why am I doing stuff that doesn't have to do with writing before 3 o'clock? Like, why am I even doing that unless it has to do with the podcast? Why? I don't know, but I was, and it was just distracting me. And now I'm like, I know what it feels like to just sit there for hours, commit yourself to that. And it's like, all right, I have a baseline here that I want to keep trying to achieve. So going forward, I want to try to do a 6 hour shift 2 to 3 times a week for the next few months, if I can.
That focused time where all you have to do is do your writing is such an opportunity. And all those little things that get in the way, we forget what they are. I mean, they don't really matter often. Some of them do, but really, like you said, if it's before 3 p.m., that's when we should be focused on these projects we have. And then you can take care of all the other stuff after 3 o'clock.
Yeah, or something. Just that stuff can be done later, no matter how pressing it seems. Like, that is the stuff I should be procrastinating on, not the writing. It doesn't feel like a choice you're making, but it is.
You know, it's such obvious things. You'd think that we would have figured this out by now.
Yeah. You know what? Everyone listening right now, let's just go blank slate. We forgive everyone and we forgive ourselves for this whole time of not knowing and or doing anything like this. So there you go. I think Bradbury would be, his spirit is with us if you believe in that kind of thing, which I don't think I do, but that's okay. I'm not sure. Anyway, so you're going to do this about like once a week now?
I think once a week for me would be a good amount. When we get all done with Bradbury, we'll check in and see how many of these ideas we've incorporated regularly into our writing practice, and we can grade it from there.
Cool. Well, I hope everybody joins us. It would be great if our listeners tried this as well and gave us some feedback on what they learned or new insights that they have or your experience. So go to Patreon. We'll have a forum on there for you to share your 6 hour stint of writing and tell us your story, your goals. Did it work out? And what are you going to do going forward?
I think one of the things that really worked out for this was we both agreed to do it on the same day. So even when you weren't moving as quickly as you said you were, you didn't put it off till Monday because we were going to do it on Friday. So usually we just put this out for our Pinto members, but maybe we'll open this post for everybody. If we can agree on a day, maybe next week or something, where we can all do our 6 hours of writing and we can all pitch in there at that point.
That would be awesome.
The community affair. So We'll set it up on the website. People can tell us what days might work. We'll pick a day and we will do 4 to 6 hours. We'll cut it back. Maybe not 6 hours because people do have to work and stuff like that, but we'll have a day where we basically commit to 4 hours. And that will be available to anybody checking our Patreon site. Speaking of which.
Yeah. Speaking of Patreon. Well, speaking of listeners, we want to do a little shout out and a thank you for some people who wrote some Apple reviews for us. So we want to have a shout out to some people who wrote some reviews of our podcast. We really appreciate these reviews. They go a long way when people are looking for podcasts and say somebody's looking for, you know, a writing podcast. The more reviews we get, the more ours will show up. Three people hooked us up. Three people left wonderful reviews.
On Apple Podcasts.
On Apple Podcasts. So BX Kiddo said that we had witty banter. And then LCAT789 said that we had helpful writing tips for actual humans.
Actual humans.
Yes, not Martians, but humans. So that was great. And then recently, just a few days ago, Ybrock N, he said, I got hooked. Or she said, I got hooked. Or they said, I got hooked. Somebody said, Ybrock N said, I got hooked, which is pretty rad. Everyone's giving us all the stars. I'm just super happy that people like us.
Thank you guys so much. And if you're listening to this podcast and you have time to go to Apple Podcasts and write a review, we'd be so grateful. And we will announce your name on the next show.
Yes, we will.
And other ways they can support us, Renee?
So you could go to Patreon and you can sign up to either of our two tiers. We have the Abby, the fabulous tier, and that'll get you bonus episodes where we workshop the activities that we do. We continue the discussions.
You can hear Renee's mini rant when the library was closed.
Oh my, have you heard that already, Kim?
I'm saving it.
So you can access those with Abby. You can also access my snark notes, which are the chapter notes for the entire chapter. So you don't even have to read the craft book, but you get my witty take on it. And then if you did the Pinto tier, Pinto the Ambitious, you would join our community forum and you would be able to share your own take on these activities. So you could do the activities with us. You'll even get feedback from us. We'll comment. And for those listeners who aren't yet ready to commit, we do have a few community posts and community forums that you can access on our website where you can share. We have different prompts on there and you can share, and you don't need to be a member to share your experiences on that.
Right. So we have some open posts on the Patreon site. So go there anyway. If you're not a member and you just want to take a look at it, you can read some of the stuff and get a taste for what's there.
Yeah, you can browse.
One of the best things, if you have a writing friend that you think would enjoy this podcast, would get something out of it, please recommend us to them. That'd be awesome.
Totally. Yeah. Sharing this podcast with listeners would be fantastic.
Okay. I think we'll call it that good for the podcast. And you will hear us in another week or so.
Hear you later, dear listener.
Bye-bye. Words to Write By is produced by Renee Nelson and Kim Smith-Adam. Our theme music is Roll Back the Carpet by Cool Cat Music. Have a great day.
Because although it was very focused, what was I going to say?